help give you some deeper insights.
Wait, I just feel like I didn't trust you when you sent me.
Yes, I know.
Oh, my God, I feel it.
I didn't send you this last week because of that.
I just tend to procrastinate. I mean, if I don't do it right away, I'll make myself a note. I think I'm losing my mind because I can't remember what I...
I'll send you the next one so you'll be able to do it. Just start forward. Good evening. I hope everybody's well. We've been talking and getting ready to get started, and so we're ready. Please join me with the Anabakoa. Anabakoa Gedula Chimincha Tati Serura Alopet Gimel Yutav Tzadi Kaberinat Amchasad Beinu Taharenu Nora Kufreshayan Sintet Nun Nagibor Dorshe Yehudcha Kevava Shamrem Nun Gimel Dalet Yud Kaf Shin Barchem Tacharem Rachamei Sidkatcha Tamid Gamrem Betetresh Tzadi Taf Gimel Chasin Kadosh Berov Tucha Nael Adatach Het Kuf Bet Ted Nunayan Yachid Ge'e Lamcha Pene Zopre Kedushatach Yud Gimel Lamed, Hey Zion Kuf. And the two letters of the month, the Resh, that created the constellation Tumim, the twins, the Gemini, and the Zion that created the planet Kohav, which is Mercury. Shavatenu kabel ushmati akatenu yodea talumot shinkufav tzadiyutav. And the last line, which we say in a whisper, which we refer to as silently, but I will say it out loud for the purposes of teaching. Baruch Shem Kivod Malchuto Le'olam Va'ed. And I'm going to read a verse from the Zohar to bring in the energy. The verse I'm going to read is a little bit esoteric. It's part of the Idra Rabba, which is a part of the Zohar that explains creation and the four phases in a very, very concealed way. So I won't probably interpret it too well, but we'll try. Vayhi Noam Adonai Eloheinu Aleinu Maaseh Yadeinu Kunanei Aleinu Maaseh Yadeinu Kunaneihu V'tana Tikuna Kadma'a D'Digna V'tinyana Li'ata'a Li'ta'a D'Piv Hen Kol Ele Yifal El Pa'amayim Shalosh Im Gaver. We have learned that the first correction of the beard and the second correction came to bring about the third correction, as it is written, Lo-El does all these things twice or three times with a man, which is a verse from Job chapter 33. And it's a very short verse and very concealed. There are 13 parts of a person's beard. And each of those relate to the 13 attributes of mercy. And each of those relate to the concept of correction. So when, as part of facing reading, one can look at the way a man's beard grows and see what aspects need to be corrected, if one is trained to do that. The Idrarabha is talking about the process of creation from the Ein Sof down to our physical world. This is the beginning of the Idrarabha. And don't be concerned if, in case you didn't understand what I read or what I said. It's just part of the process of learning. We have teachers who've written books since the Zohar was revealed in the year 1170, was written about the year just after the destruction of the temple. It was actually written over a period of about 400 or 500 years, but it was taught by Rabbi Shimon just after the destruction of the temple. And we have teachers closer to us in time and in spirituality that helps us understand the Zohar, because it's very difficult to understand it directly. It was meant to be concealed, even though it was revealing the wisdom. Before we start the class, does anybody have any questions? I hadn't decided what to teach tonight. We have been talking about the four phases, which we've covered in detail. When I say in detail, that means we could probably talk about them about another 4 or 5 years. But we also had a summary of the four phases, which was what we did last week. Now, the next things that we can start to teach, we can continue teaching about the Sefirot step by step. We can continue to teach or expand any of the other basic classes. We can expand the astrology lecture. We can expand the reincarnation lecture. So if you have any preferences, rather than you feel free to express them now, or over the next few days, if you want to send me an email of what you'd like to learn, I'll be happy to continue that path. I know Patricia's choice is to stay with the Sefirot, but I'll tell you generally, the Sefirot should be taught in stages so that you have time to absorb them, because you can't learn it all at once. And literally, I've been studying Kabbalah for 18 years. The deepest study of Kabbalah is the Sefirot. And when I say the deepest, it's also the part that will help you the most in your life. But it's also the most esoteric. It's the hardest to understand. And the way I've been taught is to bring the knowledge and the wisdom of Kabbalah to a level that people can use in their life as quickly and directly as possible. So, again, whatever subject you'd like to talk about or expand. What I thought about tonight is I'm going to talk about relativity. That relativity as it relates and is taught within the concept of Kabbalah. If you have a sheet from the previous weeks, looking at the sheet of the Sefirot, the sheet that I handed out is a picture, a diagram. It's called the Tree of Life glyph by the academic people. But But to give you some history, you've all heard of the theory of relativity by Albert Einstein. And in 1905, Albert Einstein revealed the specific theory of relativity. And about 10 years later, he revealed the general theory of relativity. And then about 1928 came the acceptance of the theory of uncertainty. All of these are relating to the concept of relativity. Now, I'm going to make a statement that, again, I caution you always, never believe a word I say. But here, experiment with what I'm suggesting that you do. In 1903, Rabbi Yehuda Ashlag wrote an article actually explaining what the Zohar says about relativity. And only because Rabbi Ashlag had revealed it on the level of Kabbalah could Albert Einstein pick up the consciousness of relativity and reveal that to the world in that level. Let's start and understand what is the Rabbi Ashlag's revelation about relativity. If you look at a glyph for the Tree of Life, it starts with Keter. It goes on the right column. Well, Keter is considered central column. On the right column, you have Chochmah. On the left column, you have Bina. The three of them represent the head. You then have a right column called Chesed, a left column called Geburah, and a central column called Tiferet. Those three represent the body. You then have a right column called Netzach, a left column called Hod, a central column called Yesod. Those three represent the body below the diaphragm. Essentially the legs and the lower part of the trunk of a human being. And finally, you have in the diagram under the central column, you have Malchut, which is the lowest sphera. You have no lines between Hod and Netzach and Malchut, which means that the only flow into the sphera of Malchut, the only flow can come through Yesod. What Rabbi Ashlag taught and revealed in a deeper way, in a more explanatory way, was within each of those spherot, there are 10 spherot. So in the level of Tiferet, there is Keter of Tiferet, Chochmah of Tiferet, Bina of Tiferet, Chesed of Tiferet, Geburah of Tiferet, Tiferet of Tiferet, Netzach of Tiferet, Hod of Tiferet, Yesod of Tiferet, and Malchut of Tiferet. And then we can take Tiferet of Tiferet, and there are 10 spherot in that sphera. And then we can take Yesod of Tiferet, of Tiferet, of Tiferet, and there are 10 spherot in that. infinitum. There is no limitation on the number or the depth of the spherot within the spherot or within the spherot. And what Rabbi Ashlag talked about with respect to relativity was a sphera is flowing down to the sphera below it and therefore is male, is sharing with the sphera below it. But it is receiving from the sphera above it. So at the same instant, every sphera is both male and female, is both sharing and receiving. What is the frame of reference must be defined in order to understand cause and effect. Gevura shares with Tiferet, but receives from Chesed. What's cause and what's effect? When Malchut says no, when Malchut says, I can't accept this light, what happens to that light? It gets reflected back. That's considered restriction. It's considered reflected light. That light goes back all the way to the Keter, all the way from Malchut. But what is the cause? The statement, I cannot receive. Therefore, it becomes a Keter, but it's Malchut. There are two terms in Kabbalah, direct light and returning light. And the way the system works, as described by the Ari and this Rabbi Ashlag, is an action below ignites the flow from above. Since the action below is the cause, it's the Keter. But it's in Malchut. It's in the consciousness of Malchut. Always talking about relativity. We need to define relativity. And recently, in the last 20 years, the physicists have started to relate the theory of uncertainty, which is false, to consciousness and understanding. And so let's understand what science is saying today relative to what these theories of relativity, the theory of uncertainty, and the consciousness of relativity. Science asks a very simple question. If you're in the woods away from civilization and a tree falls, but there is no human being to hear it, did the tree fall in this forest? Now, we've said the tree fell, but there was no human being to recognize that sound, to consciously hear, consciously say, oh, a tree fell in the forest. So what took place in the forest? Anybody want to guess? The question is, did the tree fall in the forest?
Yes.
How many say yes? How many say no? we have a majority that says yes, which is our normal human reaction and response and intuitive, not intuitive, but logical explanation. I don't have to hear it in order for it to be true. Obviously, I'm sitting in Los Angeles, but there's planes flying all over the world. I don't know that they're there. Therefore, relative to me, there's no planes in the world because I'm not hearing them. I'm not recognizing them.
But that's relative to you. It doesn't mean that it's not true. I mean,
we're going to ask the question, what is truth and what is relative truth? We're going to talk about it. But let's first understand what is relativity. The science, the modern physics says very simply, if there is no human being to recognize an event, it did not happen. That's what science says. It's also what Kabbalah says. There must be a consciousness that interacts with the event in order for the event to be real. Very deep statement, very difficult to understand, and I hope I don't confuse you further as I continue to talk.
Yeah, but if the tree fell on the forest, and then you did not hear it fall, but then you realize that it had fallen, you assume that it fell because it's not standing up from the ground.
Or, I created the universe with the tree on the ground, and it never fell.
We know that the trees are not on the ground, the trees are standing.
Why? How do you know that?
Let
me put it in a very specific question. I understand. Your questions are excellent. Your questions are trying to understand the concept. And the scientists are trying to understand the concept. Because the concept does not make logical sense. Well, let's talk in terms of immortality. I'm changing the frame from the tree to the concept of no death, immortality. Is immortality possible? Have you ever met anybody who didn't die? The answer to that is no. Therefore, how do you know that immortality is possible? I'm going to live forever, or at least more than 300 years. And every time I say that to somebody, they laugh.
You're asking me why?
It's a rhetorical question, so if you have an answer, go ahead.
Because I have no, like, some situations in my life or some places I have been there before.
That's reincarnation. That's not a question of no death.
Well, the body dies. That's not the spirit.
Well, I'm now talking on the basis that the body does not die. My body will not die.
But the body does.
It does? Who says?
Well, if you bury somebody and then you go and dig the grave, it's be there, the skeleton, whatever.
1943.
I'm incinerate.
1943. The Germans invaded, well, actually 1939, the Germans invaded Poland. But in 1942 and 43, they started moving the Jewish people into ghettos and to establish their final solution to the Jewish problem. And in so doing, they caused development to be on the grounds of Jewish cemeteries. Those Jewish cemeteries have been in Poland since the 1600s. So for 400, maybe 500 years, there were Jewish people being buried in this ground. The German soldiers were instructed to to take up the Jewish burials, the cemetery, dig it up. And they found, from time to time, they found bodies that had been buried 400, 500 years, 300 years, 100 years. They found bodies totally intact that had not disintegrated. They were buried without coffins. There was no reason for them to remain intact. The body does not die. The body, when it's corrected, will live forever. How do I know this? This is what Kabbalah teaches. We don't have time tonight to prove it to you. Nor would I ever prove it to you. You just have to.
If I go out and take my grandmother's.
If you went and dug up your grandmother's grave, if she was a tzaddiket, a righteous woman, her body would not disintegrate. The only reason the body disintegrates is because of the actions that we do that are not righteous. A few years ago, before I started studying Kabbalah, so now let's call it 20, 22 years ago, I was up late one night listening to this absolutely moronic television program that essentially was some New York pathologist describing various forms of scientifically analyzing somebody's death and saying how he died and therefore who was the person who murdered him. And they would go back through these programs and these people and these cases. One of the people who was analyzed was a person by the name of Medgar Evers, who was a civil rights leader in the 60s and was assassinated in 1966, I believe. He was dug up 28 years later at the bequest of his son, who was in the process of suing somebody looking for some money, and they needed to determine the exact cause of death. And I listened to this man, this pathologist, describe what he found when he dug up the body. He opened the casket, and it looked as if Medgar Evers had died yesterday. There was no deterioration of his body. Kabbalah teaches, when you share, you're doing a righteous act. Clearly, working for the civil rights movement would be a sharing action. The man died as an assassination. The purpose of his death had to do with the civil rights movement, cause and effect. The man died a tzaddik, a righteous person. His body was totally corrected. What the pathologist said was there was a little bit of deterioration on his wrist, his left wrist, but the rest of his body was totally undeteriorated. Yes, America.
But I thought that if you're sharing, you wouldn't be fully
No. No. There may be a reason why he needed to leave the world in this way as a motivation for other people to learn. We don't see God's plan. We see aspects of it that are relative to us, but we're not capable of seeing God's total plan. So yes, people do die, but people don't die.
So does that mean that if someone dies, the rest of them are like, the they go to the Ensof, or would they go to
Nobody goes to the Ensof until all of us complete our tikkun. We must all return to the Ensof together. Everyone goes to hell. Some for seconds, instants, and are immediately elevated to heaven, and some for longer periods of time, not to exceed 11 months, whatever that means in a spiritual time frame, which does not have time. Yes, Connie?
What's the definition of righteousness, and what's the definition of hell? That's only God wants.
Hell is...
Hell?
No, God does not want a human being to be in hell. God wants a human being to be cleansed of the physicality of the desire to receive of oneself alone, which has infected the soul. And so he has created a place called Gehinnom, which is translated as hell. And the purpose of being in hell is to cleanse the soul of that illness, the desire to receive for oneself alone.
Same thing as the Bible says, like the fire and like forever situation. That's the definition of hell. Bible.
No, that's the definition of hell in the New Testament.
Right.
That's not the definition of hell in the Jewish Bible. The purpose of Gehinnom, the purpose of hell, is to cleanse the soul so it can enter Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. To wait for the rest of us. I'm sorry?
If I'm going to...
Yes, people can create hell on earth, just as people can create heaven on earth. Consciousness defines what our lives are. We, according to the Baal Shem Tov's teachings, we create the universe we live in. So in the physical world, I'll give you an example. We have a righteous tzaddik sage who's written about in the Talmud, whose name is Gamzu Litova. Hebrew words that translate, also, this is for good. And there are many, many stories about Gamzu Litova in the Talmud. All of the stories relate to horrible mutilations of his body. He lost an eye, he lost another eye, he lost his left arm, his left leg, his right arm. But he's teaching Torah all along, all of these different incidents. He's teaching Torah. When I say he lost, somebody cut them off. Somebody abused his body. Somebody caused this to be done to him. And every time these incidents happened, he would turn to his students and teach, Gamzu Litova. Also, this is for good. The world he lived in was heaven. Because in his mind, in his consciousness, he was doing the work of heaven. The world that his students saw was hell. He couldn't take care of himself. How horrible can it be? It's all relative to where your consciousness is. This is the issue of understanding relativity. This is the issue that the scientists struggle with. Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Going back to, so according to Kabbalah, should it be buried or cremated?
They should not be cremated.
Why not?
Because if you cremate a body, you burn the body, including the one bone that will be used to resurrect the body at the time of the resurrection.
Okay.
The name of that bone is called the loose bone, and if it's recommended not to cremate, because a body that cannot be resurrected because of cremation means that there was no correction of that soul in that lifetime. So it's recommended not to be cremated.
What if a righteous person is cremated?
It wouldn't happen.
It would not happen?
It would not happen.
Because?
My sister chose to be cremated. She knew what the Jewish law was. She rejected it. Did she make a change in her life? Hopefully she did, but I don't think so. From my perspective, looking back on my sister, who I loved dearly, even though I was estranged from her the last 5 years of her life, I saw her as a beautiful soul. But I know, looking at the truth of what Kabbalah teaches. She chose to be cremated. Her children authorized that action. There was no correction in her. There cannot be a correction that ends up with the body not being buried. Now, there are Israeli defense soldiers who learn to fly and are shot down by the Arabs, the Syrians usually, but it can be anywhere. They're shot down. They die in a screaming plane, a fire-burning plane that's dropping to the ground. What happens to their bodies? Did they make correction? It's taught that if they die in the defense of the nation, they achieve total completion, total perfection, total correction. So how can that be? The truth is that somewhere in Syria, their loose bone is available. Maybe it's not buried. Maybe it is. We do try and collect all of that. You have terrorist bombings. People are blown to smithereens. But the techniques that have been developed in the Israeli government and the Israeli systems, they recover bits and pieces of the soul, bits and pieces of this body that will be used to resurrect. A righteous person will not be cremated. A righteous person will not die in this way unless it's part of God's plan. And if it's part of God's plan, it's to teach and impact other souls and other people. So you'll see the cycle.
And what about the people that died like in the Twin Towers? They were all blown up. I mean, there were like pieces everywhere.
Yes.
What about all the Jews that died during the Holocaust that were incinerated? So none of them were righteous?
None of them achieved a correction in that lifetime that wasn't achieved in a previous lifetime. And so that correction, that soul, will be resurrected in their previous lifetime. They were righteous by having died because they were Jewish. But it's more righteous if you choose to die. Someone says to you, convert or I'll kill you, and you choose to die, that's more righteous than someone who is ordered into the gas chambers and then is burned in the ovens. But even in the burning of the ovens do not destroy the loose bone. It's only in fire, and fire of a certain magnitude of heat. And generally the loose bone is always available.
So it's not the same as cremation.
Not the same as cremation. Cremation is at a much higher temperature. Any other definition of righteous is doing right.
Doing the right thing,
Holy. According to you, you create the universe you live in. So what is right for you is going to be relative to you. Can an Arab suicide bomber and the Israeli who was blown up be doing righteous actions? Both of them can be doing righteous actions. Both of them are correct relative to them. They both will end up in the Gan Eden, the heaven that their perceptions create.
Because they're both projecting what they believe in?
Because they're both projecting what they believe in. Everything is relative to consciousness.
Okay.
There is nothing else besides consciousness. And ultimately, there is nothing else besides the thought of God. We are part of the thought of God. Our consciousness is part of the thought of God. We create what happens to us. Kamzulatova, or pain and suffering. What happens in our physical world is an illusion. We've said this before, we'll say it again, many, many times. Our physical world is an illusion. What happens in our physical world is totally immaterial and unimportant, except as it relates to how we perceive it. What is our consciousness? Is our consciousness the desire to receive for oneself alone, or is our consciousness the desire to receive in order to share? This is called relativity. How do you perceive the action? Please go ahead and make the left turn in front of me. You SOB, you're turning in front of me? Which is righteous and which is not? They both can be righteous. My attitude of you SOB, you're causing 14 people to end up in a car accident because you turned in front of me. So my statement, you SOB, is a righteous thought, a righteous creation. The person who turned in front of me, he thinks he's righteous. He caused the death, of God forbid, of 14 people, which means that he will pay the effect of those 14 people's deaths. Where will he pay that effect? Could be in this world, could be in his next lifetime, could be in Gehinnom, could be in Gan Eden. All is part of the process. All is created by the consciousness. Sure.
Then what's the difference between Garden of Eden here and here?
Before you can go to the Garden of Eden, you have to clean out the total desire.
Right.
What takes place in the Garden of Eden is the study of Torah. Okay. All that you revealed of Torah in this world, you study over and over again in the next world. Is that study static? Do you think you're seeing the same study each day, each instant?
No.
It's all part of spiritual growth. But there's no place to manifest spiritual growth unless there's a body. And the only place a soul has a body is in the physical world. So the change takes place in Gan Eden, but doesn't manifest until your next lifetime. And there's a lower Garden of Eden and an upper Garden of Eden. And how do you get from one to the other? The Zohar does explain. It's all relative to the process, the consciousness, and the tree either being created on the ground or because a human being recognized the sound, therefore the tree fell.
First
what?
First class or second class?
Higher. No, it's not first class and second class.
It's different levels.
Yes, they're different spheres.
But that's a different purpose.
A different purpose, a different consciousness. What's the difference between phase one and phase two? It's the same vessel, but a different consciousness.
There's a higher consciousness.
What did you mean by higher?
There is.
Do you mean a quality of better, or do you mean closer to God? With that understanding of what higher means, I can agree with you. But higher typically means in our physical world secular conversation, higher means better. There is no difference between Keter and Malchut. And yet there is. Understanding that, where is the relative frame of reference? Understanding the frame of reference, am I talking about Malchut, of Tiferet, of Yesod, of Gevurah, of Keter, of Malchut, of Yesod, of Keter? How many was that? Seven levels? And that's just the beginning. There's that many infinite more levels. Always, each level has to be defined relative to its frame of reference. Let's use as an example, and hold your thought, let's use an example, fish tank. The fish is silver. The four glasses of the tank have four different colors. And those glasses represent Sfirot. So the red glass represents Gevurah. And the yellow glass, or the white glass, represents Chesed. Now I can put next to the white glass a red glass. And am I looking from outside, I see red through white, and the color of the fish is a color. I'm not defining it. Now I can switch the glass so that I'm now seeing white through red. Will the color I see the fish be exactly the same? It will be different. Scientifically, if I measure the frequency of the light that goes through a white and red paint, white and red glass, scientifically they will be the same frequency. But intuitively, essentially, they're going to be two different colors. How do I tell the difference? This is part of what Kabbalah teaches us to understand, that when we are being intuitive, when we are listening to our intuitive self, when we are connecting to God through our intuition, that we can tell the difference between white through red or red through white. Your question, America.
Okay. You said there is nothing except consciousness.
Correct.
Okay. This is kind of like a long-ended question, but okay. So, how do we, like, reconcile, I guess, the fact that, like, there's all this, like, suffering and stuff going on in the world if it's, like, outside of our consciousness with, like, the fact that we...
It's outside of our consciousness. It didn't happen relative to us.
But relative to us isn't the same as it didn't happen. Like, do you understand what I'm saying?
Of course I understand what you're saying. If right now I'm sitting in this chair, the only reason this chair exists is because I feel it on my bottom. If I was an inch off the chair wouldn't exist. Because I wouldn't feel it. But you would see it, and therefore, on the quantum consciousness of the world, which is all of us in unity at a consciousness level, you would, and I would know that there is a chair.
But we know that there is suffering in the world.
Yes. Why do we know there is suffering in the world?
You
see suffering in the world because you are open to see suffering in the world. I can tell you that the suffering that you see is cleansing and it's not suffering. Is there a difference in that statement?
No, because it's painful to see to see another person suffering.
But if you don't see them suffering...
You've got to be blind.
And if I say to you that it's not painful to that human being, because they know they're getting closer to God through this suffering, through this cleansing. They're getting closer to God. So the outcome is righteous.
Why am I doing?
Because for your correction, you need to feel the pain to wake yourself up, to learn to control your consciousness, to redirect your consciousness. Relative to you, you have a correction. Relative to the person receiving the pain, they have a correction. Relative to a third person who sees the pain as getting closer to God, the correction has already been achieved. They're already closer to God, and they're no longer feeling the pain. We tell a story about the death of Rabbi Akiva, who is who is the greatest intellectual, intuitive soul ever brought into this world, higher than Moshe Rabbeinu. We have a midrash that says when God and Moshe were talking at the burning bush, and God said, I want you to go release the people, free the people, and he said, Moshe said, get somebody else. Get Rabbi Akiva. He's a higher soul than me. He'll do a better job. And God said, he has his correction, you have yours. Go free the people. We know that Rabbi Akiva was the highest soul who ever came into this world. Rabbi Akiva's death was at the age of 120. He was taken out in an amphitheater of the Romans where he was strapped to a pole, and with metal combs, the Roman guards combed, peeled his skin layer by layer. I'm sorry to cause you pain with this story, but I will tell you his description, and this description is in the Talmud, and it's read every Tisha B'Av, because 10 righteous high sages died at the hands of the Romans in horrible ways. And we study this on Tisha B'Av as part of our learning, part of our righteous actions. One of his students ran up to the guards, bribed the guard to be able to talk to him. Because they didn't do it, you know, peel the skin and then he died. They peeled the skin and let him rest and recover from the pain. And then they peeled some more skin. And then they let him rest and recover and then some more skin.
They were torturing
him, absolutely correct. And his student ran up to him. Rabbi Akiva, you have studied Torah for 80 years. His life consisted of three parts. The first 40 years, he was an ignoramus. He was a field worker. He was a secular human being. And from the age of 40 to the age of 80, he studied Torah. How did he study Torah? He fell in love with a beautiful woman who was a daughter of a very wealthy man who refused to let her marry him because he was an ignoramus. And she said, I see that you can be great. I will only marry you if you'll study Torah. And he says, I can't study Torah. I'm 40 years old. I don't even know the alphabet. And he went and he sat by a brook and thought about what was going on in the world. And he watched the water create a hole in the stone and flow through the stone to get to where it wanted to go. Drop by drop, over the centuries, it had created this hole. And the light went on in his head. If water can create a hole in stone, drop by drop, I can start learning Torah a little bit at a time. And then he went and he sat in the schoolroom with little kids. As a 40-year-old man, he sat in a chair for a 3-year-old. Got to be uncomfortable. Got to be ego deflating. Got to be embarrassing. Got to be absolutely absurd. But his goal was to study Torah. And to study Torah, you have to learn the Aleph Bet. And the Aleph Bet is taught to 3-year-olds. From the age of 40 to the age of 80, he studied Torah. And from the age of 80 to 120, he taught Torah and became to be the rabbi of the generation.
So anyway, what happened to him?
His student ran up to him and said, "Is this the result of a lifetime of Torah?" And his response was, "Get away from me, snake."
What?
"Get away from me, snake. You're the Satan. You're asking me to doubt my truth. My whole life I have said the Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, and then Baruch Shem, and then the Ahavta L'Racha, the first 42 verses or words in the Shema. You say, I will love the Lord my God with all my heart, with all my might, and with all my soul. And I have always wondered what this meant, with might and soul. How can I love God with my soul? And you want to deny me the opportunity to die for my God? Get away from me, snake. Don't give me this option for connecting to uncertainty. This is what I was born to accomplish, to reach the level where I could see that to die for my God is a righteous act. And at that instant, the Roman soldiers continued to see the illusion of him and being in pain. But he felt no pain because he had reached a connection to God that was above the level of pain. The illusion still existed, but there was no feeling of pain. Consciousness is the only thing that counts. Consciousness is always relative. It's confusing. Phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, phase 4. The same vessel, different consciousness. Spiritually, they are different things. Physically, they are different things. Relatively, they are the same essence. Spiritually, there's never disappearance in spirituality. Phase 1 always exists, even though it has become phase 2. It still exists. Potentially, actually, continuously. This is what science is struggling with in understanding the theory of relativity, in understanding the theory of uncertainty, in understanding the answer to the question, did the tree fall in the forest?
Can we talk about the Big Bang?
Sure, we can talk about the Big Bang. That's called Tzimtzum, and we touched on it in the fourth.
Right.
But we can talk about it more. We're coming to the end of the class. Are there other questions before we put it down? I haven't even touched the concept of relativity. It's a concept that can take years of study. Each sphera is relative to its frame of reference and its relationship with the other sphera. Each sphera has a consciousness. And that consciousness is affected by the people who perceive that consciousness. The theory of uncertainty says, scientifically, if you measure something, while you're measuring something, you change it. That's what it says. So nominally, it says, if I try and measure the speed of light or the speed of something, I cannot measure its location. While I'm measuring speed, I can't measure location. While I measure location, I can't measure speed. But it's really saying, Kabbalistically, when I measure something, I change it. When I count something, I limit it. What is the limitation? I've changed it. It's no longer what it was before I counted it. How's your life? My life is good. Li ayin hara. My words, life and good, change what is the pattern of my life, because my consciousness has changed to put a limitation, something called good, which I haven't defined it for this conversation. Words that we use every day, when we use those same words in the concept of Kabbalah, change the words and change the thing that they refer to, and change the spiritual aspect of that thing. Is there anything that is fixed? Is there a one truth?
No, wait.
One of the names of God is the word Emet, which means truth.
Emet.
Is God truth? Is there a truth that is not relative? Ask any fundamentalist Christian, and they will tell you that there is one truth. Ask any fundamentalist of any other religion. They will tell you there is one truth. Spiritually, there is one truth, the Ein Sof, the endless world. No limitation. What does no limitation mean in the context of truth? Everything I conceive, everything that my consciousness can embrace, is righteous. I'm going to leave that thought unexplained. Hopefully you'll have some questions next week or by email.
Can you make a comment?
Sure.
When you asked me how are you doing, and I said good, that life is not a straight line.
No, it's
like,
definitely not. And the answer to you is you're absolutely wrong. Life is always good. There is nothing closer to God than being in a consciousness of good.
What about when you're in chaos?
Chaos is getting you closer to God in a longer path. You didn't have to have the chaos, but your actions created the chaos. Your consciousness created the chaos. It's a longer path getting you closer to God. It must happen in order to balance the universe. The consciousness, it's chaos, thank God. It's always good. There are 98 curses in the Torah. A curse doesn't sound like a good thing. The curse that says that mothers will eat their children does not sound like a good thing. I can tell you, having experienced a mother who was a Scorpio who goes into crisis and eats me. I've experienced it. I went to a therapist at the age of 31, having had some very difficult experiences, not knowing how to cope with my sadness, my depression. And I went to a therapist, and on his shelf, his bookshelf, is a Polynesian image of the mother with this huge mouth absorbing the head of her child. And I looked at this and said, this is my life. This is what was going on in my childhood. My mother, when she went into crisis, she didn't do it because she didn't love me. She did love me. But going into crisis, she ate me. She caused me pain. She totally did things that were horrendous for me. No, they weren't physically abusive, but they were emotionally abusive. My mother loved me. I still respect my mother. But in order for me to know myself, I have to see truth in our relationship. But that truth is only relative to me. Is it my mother's truth? When I was 40 years old, when I was 34 years old, my mother died when she was 35. She went through 3 years of a debilitating cancer in which I and my sisters cared for her and helped her and did what we could for her out of our love and out of our respect, etc. And I told my mother, here is the birth story I heard you tell me. And I repeated my birth story. My birth story was, I was born a failure. My mother hemorrhaged, almost lost me. I tried to kill her, that's why I hemorrhaged. She was rushed to the hospital. They had to do a cesarean section. The doctor went to my father and said, I can save the mother or the child, which one? And my father said, save the mother. And I tried to kill my mother, and I failed. That's my birth story. Much more extensive, and I could make it much more graphic, but it's past, been over, and I've resolved it. I only use it as an example of understanding relativity. Because when I said to my mother, this is my understanding of my birth story, she said, I was only telling you these stories because I loved you. What is truth? It's always relative to consciousness. We will see you next week when we, again, we will not know what we're going to talk about. There is classes tomorrow night on the telephone. I hope you all will join us. We will be talking about the Parasha of Naso. Good night.